So one of the signature practice of our tradition, in fact, maybe even our namesake, is Dutanga practice.
Right.
So some of them are built into our lifestyle already, but can you talk about like what the purpose of it is and taking when we take on additional practices?
Right. Yeah, I mean, some are sort of what we take on, some are what we, are sort of part and parcel of how we function as a monastery. Say, like eating in our bowls it's like a Dutanga practice, but it's what we do, and so that a lot of it is just the so much of it's around simplicity and kind of going against the grain of what we prefer, what we like, and none of them are extreme. And sometimes they're called ascetic practices, but they're much more setting a tone of simplification and just not following a normal habit pattern, and that's really important in terms of training, because so much of the training that we do, and why the strength that we end up cultivating, or stability, is the ability to be able to be comfortable in many different situations, and simplicity really helps with that. Or the occasions of putting forth effort for some reason or other, or having to cope with uncertainty, taking on a Pindabhat practice where one doesn't receive any food other than what one receives on Pindabhat. So then there's a daily uncertainty there. Am I going to get anything to eat? Am I going to get, even if I get something to eat, is it going to be what I like? And even if it's not fully sort of formed in the mind, then it's still kind of there. I can remember doing Pindabhat practice, and then it's amazing how, especially as a junior monk, and then how far the eye goes out to see if there's going to be anything left for me, on the tray or the whatever the person is on Pindabhat making offerings, and it's just sort of the eye just goes there, and so it's those are so it's sort of oh desire, fear, worry, one of the practices of eating everything in your alms bowl. It's not taking anything out and putting it in your bowl lid and separating stuff out. And it's food for a day and a night. And so that it's changing one's relationship to basic things like food and shelter and robes and sleep. I mean, that's one of the Dutangas of not lying down to sleep. And this sleeping sitting up, so there's these basic sort of things that are part of the human condition that we start to, once we're sort of settled and comfortable in our precepts and our training. Then you pay attention to push that envelope a bit. What can I do? And it's they're voluntary, and two, they're something that sometimes you only take on for short periods of time, say like a Pindabhat practice. You once a week we go Pindabhat. That's a tough practice. and so that's what one was doing, then it would be untenable. And sometimes some monks will make that determination before they go out on Pindabhat and just accept, eat that day what they receive on alms round. So it's sort of working with that, experimenting with it. So a lot of it is experimenting, three road practice, which is really tough, and then say like Tenkun Danyo did practice working with that, and then sort of okay, how to just not be using a different kinds of sweaters and socks and stuff, and it's just okay. It's an experiment, and sort of see what comes up, and how do I use it to help refine my ability to be comfortable with conditions that we actually have little control over. And in that life, I mean, we don't have much control over life, and so then being able to work with some of these practices that start to highlight that, or doing sitter's practice, and it's we get so much refuge out of being able to annihilate ourselves in sleep, and then if you don't lie down, that is it's not there, usually takes about a week to start to feel comfortable sitting up and sleeping. And I remember that the first time I took it on and did it as a first vasa at Wat Nanachat. I determined the vasa. I'm going to spend 3 months and not lie down. So then, and as it got toward the end, I was sort of fantasizing, oh, I can't wait till this is over, and then I can lie down. and then the end of the vasa comes, and I get to lie down, and you're like, oh, man, it hurts. just having a body is painful. and you're able to actually get used to a lot, and so that's something that is the Dutanga start to give you a certain flexibility or capacity to not be intimidated by the uncertainties of existence, and there's a real kind of stability or solidity that comes from those Dutangas, and you have to be measured in how you do it, because you can remember the first often at the beginning of vasa Ajahn Chah would, one of the things he used to do was just go over the Dutanga practices and remind everybody what they are, and then And the answer is, as anybody interested in taking on certain practices, and of course, apart from sort of his, hands shoot up, you know, yeah, I'll take them all. You know, he just made himself so miserable. Just, yeah, I said, you got points for enthusiasm, but not much for kind of discernment on that. So because it isn't say a competition or something. It's really those are practices, and because they say some are kind of part and parcel of our day-to-day life in most forest monasteries, and they'll take them on in different ways. So as I was mentioning the other day of Bungda Mahabua's monastery, where the whole monastery is the basis of the monastery is a Dutanga practice of just eating what one gets on Pindaba. And that was an austere practice in the early days of establishing the monastery in later years, and even when I, I first went there probably late 1970s, and Dhamma Mahabua was so respected for so long, and then people were lined up out the front of the monastery. It was but still, you know, in the end, what you've got is just what's in your, like you have to keep dumping your alms bowl out, and you end up with what is in your alms bowl, and you go back into the monastery, and take it out and arrange your bowl. So it's hard you still don't get what you want, you know, in the sense of, absolutely, exactly. Yeah. So it's a good way of taking on and investigating that nature of desire, nature of our. How do we make it a lifestyle? Again, because this is, you really want to be cultivating and developing the practice in a way that you recognize. Oh, this is. This is how I want to live for the long term, and you know, part of the part of living a monastic life is also, how do I keep challenging myself? How do I not get in a rut? How do I not get too comfortable? It's important because it's in our. It's just in our nature to habituate ourselves to pretty much anything. Being willing to challenge that, investigate it, and reflect and see what are the attachments that do come up. What are the kinds of fears and discomfort that come up, and how do I work with it? So those are some aspects of. Dutanga.
So when we do challenge ourselves, obviously it'll bring up, you know, difficulties, kilesa, suffering, etc. What are some guidelines for, like, you know, when is it too much, or how do we find out when, if and how we're benefiting from these things?
These are sort of things you can't sort of take on a superficial basis, you know, sort of like you know, try it for the first day, and yeah, of course it's uncomfortable. So as I said, like for myself anyway, and I've done say like Siddharth practice quite a few times, and it's always there's always a transition at the beginning of 5 to 7 days of getting comfortable, but not comfortable, but getting bearable with sitting and sleeping and not lying down. So you have to sort of be willing to try it out and see what happens. And some are, because we're, you know, that perspective, having a long-term perspective what is the how do I cultivate this practice over long term, and when is it that it I do need to say, like, remember one monk who was determining Pindabat and then going off on these obscure Pindabat routes, and he just wasn't getting enough to eat. And it's basically a lot of sticky rice and something, you know, some odd, you know, bit of fish or a frog every once in a while. It was really unhealthy. And had to ask him to stop. I think one monk sort of, okay. He ended up getting so constipated that he had to quit. He just wasn't eating anything that was that sticky rice was just going into a ball. So you know, you just have to pay attention to health. Pay attention to the because if it's just constant difficulty, then it's hard to work up the energy for practice. The mind needs to be brightened somehow, and part of the Dutangas is picking it up in a way that you're doing something difficult. You know that it's something difficult. You're doing something that is creating a simplicity that we're not used to or not. But it's also something, again, having some confidence or faith in the Buddha's kind of encouragement, and then recognizing that the Buddha also said these are it's not required. That's like when Devadatta was going to have all the Dutanga sort of locked into. This is a vinaya rule as opposed to a possible practice. Then the Buddha, no, it's not the way forward. So being able to, and sometimes one has to sort of like, okay, this really isn't helping right now, to ease back and not. Find some sort of new normal, or where, you know, sometimes, but then sometimes looking back over something that was difficult, there's incredible delight that comes. It's like Ajahn Jayasaro, there's this one time that Ajahn Chah was really ill, and we thought, oh man, he's not going to make it, and this time, because you know, of course, he's been sick and very ill many, many times, and then Ajahn Jayasaro sort of made a determination that he was going to as a dedication or practice to Ajahn Chah, then he would do Siddhar's practice until Ajahn Chah passed away. And then he got better. And it was like three and a half years before he passed away. And Ajahn Chah, so when he makes the determination, he doesn't back off. So it was so even when we went on Turong together in India, and he was probably about in the middle of that time, and even when places weren't, you know, it's uncertain where we're going to be staying sometimes, but you know, he made that determination, and it wasn't negotiable. And but then when he finished, it was just this incredible delight, and you know, he has spent his whole life looking back at that and say, you know, he can only have delight about that, did that. One, it was difficult. Two, he did it for Ajahn Chah, you know, in memory or in honor of Ajahn Chah, and that's something that that's another benefit having done it. Looking back, it's sort of like the Master Hua's adage: "Bitter practice, sweet mind." There.
So, what happened? What would be your recommendation for when we do make a determination, and either we figure it's not working out, or we transgress it, we break it. How do we continue from there?
Well, sometimes it's just sort of realizing that this just isn't working. This isn't helpful. I remember one time making a determination I can't remember whether it was for 2 weeks or for a month or something. I made this determination. I'm going to eat one day fast a day. And you know, in a week I was a wreck. My whole digestive system was just a wreck, and I just said, okay, this isn't good for me. Similar, I remember fasting. The first few times I tried fasting, I spent my time, after 2 days, I spent my time puking. It's really, really not helpful. So that we just have to recognize what our limitations are, and say, okay, well, that's a limitation. It's not useful. And it's not as if it's, again, it's not as if it's immoral. If it was, you know, it's just is okay. It's not working. It's a different kind of thing than making a determination to not steal or to keep the precepts on celibacy. That's a whole different, category. Making a determination to not take the life of any living creature. It's not working for me. That's not negotiable. So, yeah, those are, because there's I mean, there's moral precepts and there's renunciant precepts, and also, so, you know, the renunciant precepts are how do we work with those? How do we, you know, and sometimes we'll slip up on them, or just through either laziness or distraction, and then that's one of the benefits of confession. You can confess it. Okay. New restart, kind of restart the system.
In certain situations, when one makes an aditana, would it be done like in a formal way? Like you would like, I think I remember reading about CTTV or something like that. They would like announce it in front of you, like call the sangha or something. But I was just wondering if there's any way that it's done like that.
I've heard of that. There's many different ways. There's no template. Sometimes it's helpful to let the senior monk know what kind of practices one is doing, just so, one, to get advice, and two, that they can sort of, say the senior monks are aware of, okay, this. Oh, that's why he's getting scrawny, or oh, that's why he's so grumpy. Okay, so then there's a value to making letting somebody know, whether it's a senior monk or a peer. As a way of trying to block the roots for one, the mind that wants to weasel out of something. That's a bit difficult. It's really ordinary. So you can use that as a skillful means to do that. But it's not necessary or essential.
Maybe I could just echo the helpfulness of talking to the senior monks when I was a junior monk, talking to Ajahn Kasam or Ajahn Amaro to make an aditana, because when I was a Anagarika, I had an aditana to make a new aditana every week. Completely not tenable. I would make these foolhardy aditanas in Parameshwara and never could keep almost a single one. But then once I started talking to the senior monks, it was like, they could tell me, oh, that's unrealistic, or okay, that sounds okay, but do it, adjust it this or that way, or like this or that out for yourself. Super helpful.
So you mentioned that these are practices to be used for tools to get us out of a rut or a strongly entrenched habit. So I was wondering about, like, is there any guidelines on, like, I guess it's just a skill of developing, like, which ruts we're stuck in, kind of, and which tools to use.
Yeah.
And also, and second question maybe being, like, what are other tools besides Dutangas to use when we're really stuck in a strong habit?
Well, I mean, I think there's, one is just being willing to experiment is really important, where we're willing to experiment and then looking at the things that we take as crutches or as props for a sense of self, a sense of, like, I remember one Pansa, I can't remember, it was fourth or fifth Pansa, and I made an aditana to not do any aditanas. It was just because it was sort of like, you know, been trying to do this, trying to do something special, wait a minute, it's just learn how to watch the mind, and. Because sometimes you can turn it into a thing as well. So, you know, there's different. Just the way that defilements fool us, and how we get caught up in different kinds of reactions or positions or whatnot, and in being able to. I think one of the things that's important is just for really, really undermining, say, deep-seated ruts and conditioning is finding ways to keep re-establishing a faith and trust in the Triple Gem. It's just so important, and that kind of in different ways how to really abide with a refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, which is you know, because it just keeps getting deeper and deeper. Because usually we try to get some kind of practice or some kind of result or some kind of, and it's so much about me, and that giving oneself to the Triple Gem and really finding a solid refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha is really an opportunity for relinquishment and real ease.
Maybe switch gears just a little bit. This is just this answer is just reminding me of the importance of Brahmaviharas. And I know for myself, a lot of my kilesas have to do with fear and anger and things. And so, just thinking about how the Brahmaviharas, what are the importance of Brahmaviharas for Westerners, maybe especially, but also balancing out Dutanga practices.
Yeah, I think that is actually really an important perspective, in the sense that it can be that kind of commitment to the Dutangas it makes for very, very grim states of mind. And it doesn't have to, but I mean that's sometimes what comes up, because sometimes what it triggers in us is a competitive mind, or a kind of a, I'm really going to beat up on my kilesas now, and I'm going to really conquer them. It's not a good mind state to start with. So the grounding and cultivation, grounding oneself in and cultivation of the Brahmaviharas is really such an important piece of the the whole path, really, because it does, I see, the fruits of the practice. Again, you think back think of the qualities of the Buddha, which of course that's what we're trying to cultivate, and that those wisdom, compassion, purity, and those are three kind of legs that the Buddhist practice stands on, and those are what create a stability. You've got enough of a foundation to be able to have a solid base, and they need to be balanced and attended to, so that those aspects of compassion, loving kindness, the Brahmaviharas, these expansive, bright states of mind, states of being, are really, say, uplifting and soothing for the mind. If we're constantly trying to be pure, And of course, and see, the thing is, all of them are necessary. That sense of purity in that there is a commitment to relinquishment of greed, hatred, delusion, a commitment to selflessness, a commitment to a quality of effacement. Then, of course, the practice is an essential part of the practice. But then, you know, it's also human nature to get obsessed with purity, which is, say, like those right, they say, sila bhatta paramasa, is that seeking purity out of some kind of practice, some kind of precept, some kind of something that I do is going to make me pure. And so that's an obstacle. That's one of the main obstacles to stream entry. So it's sort of the inside of the Dhamma is blocked when we're focused on purity. But it doesn't mean we don't keep those precepts. We have that commitment to effacement. But it needs to be balanced with wisdom and compassion. And similarly, wisdom on its own, without the other two, can end up being very either over analytical, over rational, over over clever. You know, if you get it all figured out, and you sometimes meet people who are Buddhist practitioners who know the teachings and know they've got the book knowledge, they've got it all in place, and they're just insufferable to be around if they use it as either as a club or as a prop for their own sense of self worth, or to tear down others, and that happens. In all of the Buddhist history and in the Buddhist world, I mean, it's just the nature of mind. So that's where those aspects of wisdom, compassion, purity are the tradition. It's like when we do the chant Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa, that's pointing right to those qualities. Arahaṃ Samma Sambuddho Bhagavā. It's like Bhagavā, the Blessed One, is the embodiment of loving kindness and compassion. Arahaṃ is in Thai, it's interesting because when the word Arahaṃ is one who's far from defilement, and that's a commentarial, very, very old way of expressing purity. So that it isn't, again, the sense of, oh, you don't have to kill all the kilesas, you just need to not get close to them. Samma Sambuddho is self-awakened, and so that's that quality of wisdom. Those three qualities are the qualities that we need to rely on. So that loving kindness and compassion are really essential pieces of a balanced heart, balanced mind.
And over time, with like the different practitioners, like you mentioned Ajahn Jayasaro or many, there's other monks who have successfully put these dutangas and the practices into for good effect. What are some of, like, I don't know, what are some common themes of the results that you've seen in practitioners who made good use of these practices?
Well, I think it's sort of, when somebody makes good use of those practices, they're probably making good use of all the different practices. So it tends to, it's not specific to the Dutangas. I think it's that those are kind of part of that interest in training and trying the different aspects of training and learning how the training works and how the Buddha's teachings really affect me. How can I implement them? What's the effect? So there's an interest, and that the fruits, of course, are in just the well-being and clarity, and these are people you want to draw close to, both because of their their clarity, their wisdom, but also their pleasing beings to draw close to.